Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Sickle cell disease afflicts about 100,000 Americans, mostly African Americans. It is a blood disease that can cause pain and a host of other physical complications. There still is much to learn about sickle cell, and that's why there's research. But the only known cure is bone marrow or stem cell transplant. Joining us on today's program is Joseph Robinson, Executive Director of the South Central Pennsylvania Sickle Cell Council. Joe Robinson, always good to see you.
Likewise, Scott. How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well.
Great.
Peyton Williams is a 19-year-old advocate who is living with sickle cell disease. Peyton, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us on the phone is former Penn State All-American, a 14-year veteran of the NFL, and current assistant coach with the Baltimore Ravens, Bobby Engram. Bobby is also president and co-founder of the Bobby Engram Sickle Cell Foundation, named after his daughter, Bobby, who passed away last year. Bobby Engram, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Bobby Engram and his wife will be speaking this Friday. The South Central Pennsylvania Sickle Cell Council will hold its annual fundraising event this Friday in Camp Hill. If you have a question or a comment about sickle cell disease, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Bobby Engram, let me start with you. Your daughter, Bobby. And by the way, Bobby, your daughter, spelled with an I, as opposed to your name. Bobby Engram, your daughter, 20 years old, passed away last September, September of 2018. First of all, very sorry for your loss, and my condolences go out to you and to your family. Tell us a little bit about Bobby.
Thank you for that, the condolences. She was a phenomenal young lady, and she had a passion and a compassion for other people. And she was really the reason that we started the foundation. You know, early in her life, actually when she had a hospitalization, me and her mom, Deanna, we were sitting in the hospital room with her while she was getting treatments and the IVs and being, you know, attended to make her feel better. And she asked a question that really got us thinking. She said, what do other kids do that can't afford the hospitals, can't afford the medicine, and don't have people to take care of them? So that kind of planted the seed. And shortly thereafter, me and my wife did some research, and we started our 501c3 nonprofit and just been trying to help other people and bring awareness to the cause ever since. But she loved music, she loved writing, she loved singing, anything artistic, and she loved family time. So she was a sophomore at Towson University here in Baltimore, and she was an honor student in spite of all of the challenges that she faced. So she was just somebody that once you got to know her, you would love her.
When was she diagnosed with sickle cell disease?
She was diagnosed at birth. And they do newborn screening now for every child that's born to see if they have sickle cell. And you mentioned that it was a hereditary blood disorder, which is true. And the only way that you can have sickle cell is if your parents, each one of your parents, carries the sickle cell trait.
Did you know that you and your wife carried that trait?
I didn't. We did not, because neither one of us ever had anybody in our families for generations that had sickle cell disease. Once we found out that Bobby had the disease, obviously there was discussion with both of our parents, and they go, you know what, we knew we had the trait, but it was just something that we never really thought about talking about because nobody ever had the disease. So, you know, it just opened up a world of discussions with our parents and our families, and that dialogue has continued now with other families, and that's something that we try and educate people on. Is one thing you can do is get trait tested to see if you would even have the possibility, once you got married and started having children, if you would have the possibility of having a child with sickle cell.
So when Bobby was born and the doctors told you, now did they say that she actually had the disease or that she had the trait?
No, they said she actually has sickle cell disease.
Okay. Did they tell you and your wife what her life would be like? I mean, what she could expect?
No. At the time, I don't remember them giving us a lot of details. I'm sure that they educated us some, but we really felt like it was on us to educate ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we started doing. You know, we started talking to doctors. We started reading. and we started basically trying to find out what her life would be like and the best way for us to take care of her as her parents.
So as she was growing up, what was her life like? I mean, as you mentioned, you know, she seemed to be a very passionate person, have a lot of compassion, had a lot of interest, was a good student. But what about physically? Did she have, what kind of symptoms did she show?
Well, let me just say that, and not to sound crude, but sickle cell disease really is a silent killer.
Yes.
Because when you look at the young person or whoever's affected by this disease, they look normal on the outside. They look like any of us walking around with no issues. The problem is when they have a pain crisis, and what that is when the normal red round blood cells that carry our hemoglobin, carry oxygen to the body, the normal blood cells are nice and round and plump, and they carry lots of oxygen, and they flow through our arteries and veins freely. When the pain crisis occurs, there's a sickling of the cells, which causes a coagulation in the blood, which stops the blood flow, and it causes severe pain. And that could be in muscles, it could be in joints, it could be in different extremities, and I mean, it's pretty intense. It's very serious pain, to the point where it has to be treated with opioids if the pain escalates too high. So she had a great quality of life in terms of her daily life. You know, like all of the things that I mentioned, you know, she has siblings that she loved. She loved getting in the pool. She loved having fun like any other kid. But her life did have some limitations because of the disease. And it was really bad whenever she had to have a hospitalization. Mm. I mean, that's when it becomes really bad. And the thing that people also don't realize is that the accumulation of pain crises over years, it affects the internal organs. The heart, the lungs, the kidneys, the spleen, there's a residual effect that happens to people that continuously have the pain crisis. So although she had a great quality of life, she had some very real struggles and battles with this disease and being hospitalized. And people don't generally think about it, but sickle cell disease has the highest rate of reoccurring hospitalizations of any disease that we know of.
I have heard that through my research. I hate to ask this, Coach, but I mean, because I know it's painful. But what happened last year that sickle cell took Bobby's life?
Yeah, she had a hospitalization, which unfortunately for. As I'm sure Peyton can attest to, the frequent hospitalizations, they are difficult to deal with physically, but also emotionally, spiritually.
Yes.
For not just the patient, but for also the siblings. You know, she had two younger brothers and a younger sister, and me and her mom. It was every time we went into the hospital, it was a very emotional thing. So in this particular one, it went bad really fast. So she was in the hospital in Johns Hopkins here for a week. Normal sickle cell pain crisis. When I say normal, I mean just, you know, it's normal pain, normal treatments, normal medication. And when I say medication, I'm talking morphine. I'm talking Toradol. I'm talking some heavy drugs.
Dilaudid.
Dilaudid, correct. Mm-hmm. To try and control this, to manage this pain, to get it back down to zero. And they always rate it on a scale from 0 to 10. And God forbid it ever escalates to a 10. But we try and manage the pain. But what happened is me and her were actually sitting in the hospital room, and we were about to get discharged when she complained for the first time ever of complications like her breathing. So long story short, she ended up having an acute chest syndrome, which is basically a sickle cell pain crisis in the chest, in the lungs. Mm-hmm. And she had to be rushed to ICU. I mean, we went from about to walk out of the hospital to her being in ICU and fighting for her life. And this was in April, May of 2018. And by the grace of God, she battled for a week. And we ended up getting her back stable when we didn't know if she was going to walk out of that hospital again. She left the hospital. She was doing great, and God blessed her with 5 more months to live, and live she did. But she ended up falling asleep on August the 25th, and she basically never woke up, and they said that her heart just gave out.
Well, again, so sorry to hear that. I mean, it's a heartbreaking story. Peyton Williams, you've been sitting here nodding your head. And so what Bobby Engram just described sounds very familiar to you.
Yes, that's my life.
We'll talk about what your life has been like and is like with sickle cell disease.
Yes. Well, my story is a little bit different. I was actually adopted by my parents at birth. So when they found out, they didn't even know exactly what I had. All they knew was, hey, your daughter has a blood disease, is all they told my parents. So it was kind of frustrating and scary for my parents because they didn't know what to think. Sickle cell at the time was not common around. Nothing was really told to parents what to do, how to treat it, anything like that. So adopting me and then figuring this out, it was very scary. Once we did find out, my parents were very, very good at doing the research, teaching me my signs and what to do and how to be vocal on what I'm feeling at the time. So we started at Philly. At the time, Hershey wasn't even, we didn't have anything in Harrisburg region to even get treated. So
we do now, right?
We do now. So right. We have in Hershey Medical Center, yes. Mm-hmm. But at the time, there was nothing. So anything that happened, we had to go to Philly. Which is 2 hours. So doing that back and forth, living with a big family. Well, I'm a sibling of 23. So being a sibling of 23 and the only one with sickle cell, I was the main focus at the time. So going back and forth to Philly just to get doctors and blood drawn, anything like that to figure out what to do was very difficult.
So you were going to Philadelphia,
yes,
even when it wasn't a hospitalization,
yes,
or
anything,
like a pain event,
yes,
that Bobby had described.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just anything.
It was anything I was going to,
wow,
Philly for, driving back and forth to Philly. My dad worked at Hershey making chocolate. He would get off work in the morning at 7, come home and just pick me and my mom up around 8 and get on the road to get to my appointments, anything like that. So it was very difficult. Finally, we found Hershey, and I was lucky enough to start at Hershey. But my story is a little bit different because I actually still develop, I still make fetoglobin. Fetoglobin is a cell that you make as an infant. Everyone makes it, and it kind of helps infants fight different disease, not diseases, but sick, sickness and stuff,
mm-hmm,
like that.
Illness.
So I still make it. To this day, I still make some fetoglobin. So I was a little bit, what you would say, lucky or well off. So at first, they didn't even really believe that I had sickle cell. They kept telling my parents, I don't think this is what she has. Her levels are too good, things like that. So I wasn't even getting the proper treatment at first because they didn't want to believe what my blood was telling them.
But were you in pain and showing,
yes,
any other symptoms?
Mm-hmm. So I had symptoms here and there. So for sickle cell patients, it's very common, like he said, to get a reoccurrence and go into the hospital. Sometimes it's month after month you'll go back in, and it seems like every month there's something else going on. But for me, mine was like once a year. Maybe,
really?
Once every 2 years I was in the hospital. So I didn't really know the extent of my sickle cell until my senior year.
Mm.
My senior year was the year that I realized that what I'm living with is very, very dangerous and something not to play with.
And, you know, Joe, we had Peyton on the program, I think it was last year,
mm-hmm,
but you were on the phone because you were
having... I was hospitalized.
You were,
yes,
hospitalized at that time.
Yes.
So this pain... How would you describe it?
The best way I describe it to people is, you know, when you do a real good workout and you know the next day you're going to be sore and hurting and you could barely get out the bed. You know, every move you feel like, ooh, tensed.
Yeah.
That's the best way to describe it. But think about that, your whole body. and there's nothing you can do but get drugged up with opioids to try to bring it down.
Well, we're going to talk to Joe Robinson in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Smart Talk Road Trip returns to the Extraordinary Give in Lancaster on Friday, November 22nd. Join us at the Holiday Inn of Lancaster Extraordinary Experience event, where we'll broadcast live beginning at 9 a.m. RSVP at WITF.org/events, supported by Roof Advisory Group. Today, during this portion of the program, we're talking about sickle cell disease. And our guest today, Joseph Robinson, Executive Director of the South Central Pennsylvania Sickle Cell Council, Peyton Williams, and she's a 20-year-old, I understand. She was corrected during the break. She's living with sickle cell disease. And former Penn State All-American, 14-year veteran of the NFL, current assistant coach with the Baltimore Ravens, Bobby Engram. He is president and co-founder of the Bobby Engram Sickle Cell Foundation, named after his daughter, Bobby, who passed away last year. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.com. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Joe Robinson, two powerful stories, but I think it just lets people know what those who are living with sickle cell disease, what they go through, and in Bobby Engram's case, what the families go through, and then Peyton describing it. I mean, so where are we with research? I mean, one thing that I did want to ask Bobby, and I'll ask him a little bit later, is the changes he have seen in the 20 years of Bobby's life, but where are we with research and treatment? And, you know, as Peyton had mentioned, that this is just recently being treated at Hershey.
Yeah, it is. May I just take a moment, though, also, and just say a little bit about the council itself for those out there who may not know. But the South Central PA Sickle Cell Council was founded in 1994 for the express purpose of helping patients like Peyton. It was because of another patient who underwent similar complications following hospitalization and surgery that prompted area physicians, Drs. Donald Spigner in particular, Herman Lawson, and Dr. Gwendolyn Poles, all to come together and form this council to provide supportive services to the families who are living with this disease. So the purpose of the council was not only to support the families, but to do all that we could do to help facilitate the education of area physicians. And that led to the formation of this Pediatric Sickle Cell Treatment Center at Hershey.
Now, by the way, Dr. Poles was scheduled to be
with us
this morning, but she had a last-minute engagement that she couldn't be here.
Correct. In fact, incidentally, she's meeting with Hershey this morning because we're in intense discussion with them now as they're trying to formalize their adult sickle cell treatment program there. And so we're excited about that because Peyton is now transitioned to adulthood. And so she's being seen there. And so we're trying to formalize that program even more so at Hershey. So we're in partnership with them to make that a more comprehensive adult treatment process there at Hershey.
When you mentioned education, are there people, I mean, even physicians, that still have to be educated about sickle cell disease?
Yes.
Really? Peyton says yes, emphatically.
Yes.
Why do you say that?
Because not every sickle cell patient is totally different.
That's right.
It's so much. We have the common symptoms. We come in with the common symptoms, but we have different things that trigger those or different ways that they need to be handled. And I see myself a lot of times, I'm very, very, very vocal on my treatment.
I have a feeling you would be. Just in the half hour we've spoken, Peyton.
Because this is my life. This is my life. I'm living with this, and I have to deal with this. So if I'm not vocal on what I need to do to survive, who else will be? My parents can do it. The Sickle Cell Council can do it. But they're not living with this disease. I am. So I make sure that I'm very vocal with my treatment. One thing I try to do, is when I get into the ER, I automatically let them know, hey, I need fluids, which is IV to help bring more oxygen into my blood. I need medicine. I let them know which medicines work for me, which ones are too strong for me, ones that make me too nauseous, anything like that. I make sure that they know what my counts, my blood counts, so what my levels are usually at, my common base. And if there's anything lower than that, that means something's going on. If it's anything higher, that means something's going on. I also let them know, hey, do a blood culture. Check my blood. See if there's something going on.
I have to smile because they must, when they see you coming. So Bobby Engram, it sounds as if, you, as you said, that you and your wife did a lot of research, and obviously Peyton has, that you have to advocate for yourselves. Is that, what have you noticed in changes in how sickle cell is treated over the 20 years of Bobby's life?
First, let me give kudos to Peyton for, and her parents, for teaching her to be an advocate. That's one of the things that we really stressed with Bobby, because she was the exact same age. She was 19, 20 years old. She was in college, so now she had to be able to talk for herself and to verbalize it for herself. Even as a young girl, we would sit in a room, but we would make her talk.
Yep.
She had to take the initiative, and she had to talk to the doctors to make sure she could verbalize exactly what she was going through. So, Peyton, I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
I'm proud for your parents for having that approach.
Thank you.
You sound very strong and very confident. I know that you're doing really well.
You'll meet her on Friday, too, Bobby.
Yes.
I can't wait.
I'll be speaking.
Let's take a phone. Go ahead. We're going to say, Bobby.
If you need to take the call, you can. But a couple of things that were mentioned that I just want to make sure I touch on. Number one of the biggest things that I'm excited about, just to hear Joe mention, is transitional care. That's a huge piece, because when you go from being a child to being an adult, the care is very different. They take care of kids a lot better than they take care of adults. So the transitional care is something that not just on a regional level, but on a national level, we have to make sure we address. Number two, you mentioned, 100,000 is the number in the beginning of your program, and that's generally the number that we all talk about. But there's grumblings in the community that this number may be significantly higher than that 100. And so we're really trying to start a campaign where we get a national registry, and we know everybody that's living with this disease in our country, and then that will allow for the proper treatment. The ER room, it's a very bad place to be when you have sickle cell disease.
Yes, yes.
And one of the simple things I'll tell you is this. The medical community is taught to dose up. So whenever you go into a doctor's office, and that's normal, like you give them the medicine that they need at that time to dose up to take care of the problem. Well, sickle cell disease is the total opposite. If the pain escalates, then you have to use more medicine. So in theory, you should dose down. You should chop the pain off.
Yes.
When my daughter went in, if we gave her the proper medicine and the pain was stopped, then we could take her home that same day. If we sat in the emergency room for 2 hours, which we have before, 2.5 hours, and the pain escalated, she stayed in the hospital as long as a week or a week and a half.
Yep.
Well, there's some different things. There's some conversations that have to be had within the medical community to address the sickle cell disease a little bit differently than most.
Hmm. Let's take a call from Zach in Harrisburg. Zach, you're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Doing great.
Hello.
I'm sitting here listening to you guys. You guys are welling up so much emotion in me as a parent, because my two kids were one of the first two kids at the Hershey program. And my daughter has since went on to graduate from Howard University as a lawyer.
Excellent.
And my son graduated from, I'm getting emotional. My son graduated from Pitt. In computer science, and he came out 11th in his class.
Yes, that's good.
And I want to get to this point so I don't forget it, because he has written a program called First Step. It's on the App Store now. And what it does, just like you were saying, Morgan, what it does is it helps kids transition from childhood to adulthood by taking all your medical records with you on its own platform. So when you get into a crisis, that medical professional can look into your record, see what your last numbers were, and track you that way. They can go in and see the history of your numbers. Because like you said also, I agree, not everybody's the same. What's a low number for you, maybe you're normal, you know? And your provider needs to know that that's your normal.
Right.
So that they don't do something radical to hurt you even further.
Yes. Definitely.
You And my kids went to a couple crises at Hershey where they had to have blood transfusions. And as a parent, that's a whole other thing you got to worry about in the age of HIV and everything else.
Yep.
You know, making sure that the blood is what it needs to be. Well, and when my daughter's last stay at Hershey, we couldn't figure it out. She was on her third week, and we couldn't figure out what was going on. And we had a visiting physician from Indonesia. She was just visiting, and she diagnosed my daughter because what happened, my daughter had a bone marrow virus, which was shutting down her white blood cells. You know, and so sometimes, you know, in these situations, you need a different set of eyes, mm-hmm. you know, to see what's going on because it's so different for each patient.
Zach, I have to cut you off. I hate to cut you off, but you should be proud of your kids.
Yes.
Obviously, you're a very loving father, but thank you very much for your call. You know, Joe, you could hear Zach getting emotional, and he has a lot to be proud of. You can tell that there are a lot of families that when their kids are diagnosed, that obviously they love their kids,
take
a great interest. But what about some of the families that Bobby mentioned very early on about his daughter, Bobby? So what do families do if they don't have that kind of family support or don't have the kind of resources that, you know, a former NFL player has, or, mm-hmm. you know, Peyton, his adoptive family? What about kids in a situation like that?
Yeah, and we certainly encourage as many people. That's why we're here, and we thank you for allowing us to be here. That's why we want people to know about the council.
Yes.
We have a very competent social worker, Deborah Bizard, who has worked with this population for some time, and she's very adept at getting patients connected with the care that they need. So we encourage people to contact our organization so that we can help you navigate those waters, if you will.
We'll put the link to your website on ours, WITF.org. Only have a few minutes left. Joe, the event this
yes,
Friday.
This coming Friday. And I'd like to give a kudo to my event coordinator, Judy Chandler, who's been organizing this event. But we're getting ready to have our soiree event. Bobby Ingram is going to be our keynote speaker, he and his wife Deanna. And Peyton will be there, and we're going to have a silent auction and soiree event at the Radisson Hotel this coming Friday at 5:00 p.m. And it's going to be a grand time. Jimmy Wood, the noted internationally acclaimed pianist, jazz pianist, will be providing the music for us. But it's a great day, great door prizes. Bobby's bringing some great gifts from Baltimore. I'll let him tell you about that. But for those of you who may be Ravens fans or just NFL aficionados, you want to get that.
Seattle fans,
that's right. Bobby's bringing the stuff. Penn State. Bobby's bringing it all. plus, we already have Best Authentics, who also has a lot of gear. And then we've also identified a lot of other door prizes that are suitable for people from all income levels. So we encourage people. We are sold out, but we do have a couple more vacancies. I just got a couple cancellations this morning. So if you're interested, give us a call. We'd love to have you join us on Friday.
Well, I want to thank the three of you for being with us,
telling
your stories, and hopefully it provides a little bit of more education for people.
Yes.
And as Bobby Ingram said, about getting tested as well. Bobby Ingram, Joe Robinson, Executive Director of the South Central Pennsylvania Sickle Cell Council, Peyton Williams, 20-year-old living with sickle cell disease. Thank all three of you for being with
us.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. In our last segment, that was part of WITF's Transforming Health Project, a deeper look at changing tide of healthcare. Check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be talking with the president of Gettysburg College. You also can visit our website to get an outlook of conversations that we're working on. The Kings Gap State State Park in Cumberland County is known for its scenic views and terrific hiking trails. Another attraction in the park is the Cameron Maslin Mansion, a landmark that has a unique history of its own. Ron Turo is a member of the Cumberland County Historical Society and of the group Friends of King's Gap. And Ron contacted me and said, "You talk about this on the air because there's a history at King's Gap with the Cameron Maslin Mansion that most people don't realize." So here we are. Ron, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Great to be here.
Also joining us is William Forey, retired director of the Pennsylvania State Parks and founder of the King's Gap Environmental Education Center. He's chair of the Pennsylvania Recreational and Park Society Government Affairs Committee and serves on the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources Advisory Council. Mr. Forey also authored a book on the history of Pennsylvania State Parks. William Forey, welcome to the program.
Yep, thank you. Good to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so how did this all come about that you actually have an event scheduled this Saturday night, King's Gap, from personal playground to public treasure this Saturday? But Ron Turo, how did this all come about?
Once again, out of my crazy mind, I've been a member of the Cumberland County Historical Society for a couple years, and we have various programs throughout the year. Cumberland County has a wonderful history, as you know, Scott, and I recently joined the Friends of King's Gap, and when I realized that the history of this mansion, the history of the property, is so interesting and unique, and tied very closely, by the way, to Harrisburg, and of course to national history because of the Cameron family, I approached the Historical Society, and I said, I'd like to put on this program and bring in some people that have personal knowledge, primarily Mr. Forey, who was very involved in and directed the acquisition and the creation of the Education Center. And we're also going to have Judge Maslin, who, as the name implies, is a member of the Maslin family who owned the mansion for several years. And he's going to talk about the history of the Maslins and their involvement. And then we're going to talk about the current use of the property and sort of the futuristic look. So we're going to cover sort of four time periods concerning the mansion and the park. And I thought it would be interesting to the public, and we're getting a really good response sign-ups for our event on Saturday, which starts at 9 o'clock at the mansion.
Mm-hmm. That's 9 a.m.
Right? 9 a.m.,
right,
yes.
Okay. Don't want to make like Monday Night Football 9 o'clock
no,
or something
no, it's, yeah,
like that.
9 a.m. Yeah.
World Series game starting. Mr. Forey, as I mentioned, you had written a book about the history of Pennsylvania State Parks. They all have their own unique histories. We're going to get into some of the specifics here in telling the story in just a moment, but what's unique about King's Gap?
Well, the thing that's unique is the mansion itself. We only have one other state park, that's Nolde Forest in Berks County, where there's a mansion involved. So that that's really makes it unique, and the building itself is unique, as you know.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe the building for those who haven't been there?
Well, it's a beautiful thing made of stone. It looks almost like a fort, and it was built like one because James Cameron, when he built it, was definitely afraid of forest fires. So the outside is stone, and every floor is reinforced concrete.
Mm-hmm. All right, so Cameron Maslin. Cameron is a name that is synonymous with Pennsylvania history. Simon Cameron was probably best known nationally for being Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of War to begin at the beginning of the Civil War. But let's talk about the history itself of this mansion.
Well, in terms of Cameron's involvement, and of course, Mr. Forey knows an incredible amount about this, but I've come up to speed a little bit. Cameron must have fallen in love with that part of South Mountain in Cumberland.
Simon
County.
Cameron?
No, James Cameron.
I was going to say that James Cameron is Simon Cameron's.
He is Simon Cameron's grandson.
Okay, I was going to say. Yeah.
So we have Simon Cameron, who, as you said, was he was Secretary of War for Abraham Lincoln. Simon Cameron's son became a U.S. senator, and also then became, I believe, Mr. Forey, the Secretary of War for Ulysses S. Grant.
Yeah, that's right.
So both the Camerons were both U.S. senators from Pennsylvania, and they were Pennsylvania power brokers. They were the real deal. So the second Cameron had James Cameron, who was the builder of the mansion. He was his only son. Ironically, never married till he was 62. Very quiet, reserved guy, but a major industrialist. He was an owner of Dauphin Deposit Trust Company. He was owner of all types of businesses, tobacco farms. He was a big horseman. I believe he raised Hackney horses, owned the Donegal Estate down in Lancaster County. But at some point, we're not sure exactly how, but he fell in love with this area, and he ended up buying over 2,500 acres and picked out a spot where he thought this would be the place to build this incredible summer home, which became the King's Gap Mansion.
So it was built as a summer home.
It was built as a summer home. He and Mr. Forey advised me that two of his sisters would live there from May to October. They didn't want to be up there during fire season, which of course was later. And of course, as you know, the other thing that's tied into all this, Scott, is the fact that South Mountain was completely decimated by the charcoal industry, as were all the mountains around Pennsylvania. So it was clear cut down to nothing. It started growing up because the charcoal industry ended in the late 1800s. So by the time Cameron bought this property, it was starting to come back. But again, as Mr. Forey mentioned, Cameron was so concerned about fire that he said, you know what, I'm going to build this out of stone. I'm going to reinforce it with concrete. He was way ahead of his time in terms of building opportunities and the way he did things. Plus, he was sitting on the top of a mountain in the middle of what was essentially, I mean, it was wilderness. Cumberland County in 1906 was wilderness compared to, you know, downtown Harrisburg. So he had to bring water in, ultimately build a generator house. They used to cut ice from Laurel Lake, which is in Pine Grove State Pernis, and they would bring that up to the mansion. They put it into an ice house until the 30s. So it's amazing to walk through this property and see the vision this man had. And as it's situated, it looks over the Cumberland Valley. It's absolutely a spectacular view, just one of the best. I'm a docent there, and people come from all over the country, and they stand out on the patio and look over, and they just marvel. It's incredible.
Well, you know, Bill Forey, we both have mentioned fires. I mean, obviously, we hear a lot about fires today, mostly on the West Coast, the western part of the United States. I mean, was that big of an issue in that time period in Pennsylvania forests?
Well, years ago in Pennsylvania, there were many more fires than today, and a lot of it from the steam locomotives. So fire was of concern.
Mm. All right. So the Camerons built, James Cameron builds the mansion. How long is he around? The Camerons own the mansion, and when did it become part of the Masland family?
Well, he built it he started in 1906, right. Finished in 1908. His family owned it till he was alive till 1949. In 1952, I believe, the Maslin Company, which was a major carpet manufacturer located in Carlisle, bought the mansion, and they owned it until the early 70s. And then Mr. Forey emerges in the early 70s and helps acquire it for the state.
We'll talk about that in just a moment, but there is a kind of a trivia thing here with the carpets and the Maslin family. Talk about that, if you would, having to do with automobiles.
Well, yeah, interesting. So in the 50s, in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, we didn't have hotels and motels.
That's hard to believe nowadays.
I was going to say, considering the transportation
hub. Probably didn't have warehouses
no.
or
truck
terminal.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So the Maslins were looking for a place that they could sort of wine and dine their customers for the automotive industry. So they would bring in executives from General Motors and Chevy and Ford and whatever. And then they would regularly change out the carpets in the rooms to show the current carpet that was being manufactured, the current style, the current color. And rumor has it, and again, Mr. Forey would know better than me, but that the Maslins brought together these executives, and at the King's Gap Mansion, they sort of basically gave Maslin the almost the monopoly on automotive carpet, which was huge when you think about it. Every piece of automotive carpet made in this country went into the car was made by the Maslin Company. So it was a major deal, and it obviously proved its worth by having a place that you could bring people like that and have a sit down with the boys and maybe a cigar and a glass, and that's how things were done.
So how long did this go on, Bill Forey, as far as the monopoly almost on automobile carpeting?
Well, Frank Maslin has said that in the large room there in the mansion that that he had convinced the then big three automakers that carpet should be put in every car. And, of course, he succeeded in doing that. But then Frank Maslin retired and his son became president of the company. And Ron mentioned, hotels, motels started to emerge, and no longer do they need the mansion to take care of their business people. So they put it up for sale. And the story is that four men from Carlisle took out an option to buy it, but they couldn't muster up the money to pay for it. So the day after the option expired, Frank Maslin had Secretary Maurice Goddard of DER down for lunch and convinced him that the state should buy it. So Goddard agreed, but he didn't have the funds at that time, so he called in the Nature Conservancy, and the Conservancy bought it, and within 2 years, enough money came into the oil and gas fund to pay for it. So in 1973, the state took over 10 acres, just the mansion around it. A year later, then 1,409 additional acres. And, of course, since then, the state has operated as a state park.
Hey, it's something you said that Mr. Goddard, Secretary Goddard, didn't have the money to pay for it. It wasn't his personal money. It was
that's right.
The state's money, right?
Exactly. Well, he was there so long that it sounded like it was his.
It was his, yeah. And by the way, I'll just mention this in passing, that WITF-TV has produced a documentary on Maurice Goddard, and it is available to watch on our website right now, and I heard just people who have watched that documentary over the years have raved about it. And of course, Maurice Goddard is legendary here in Pennsylvania, and you had the privilege of working with him.
I did for 19 years.
And Mr. Forey is in that documentary.
Oh yeah, I'm well aware of that.
Tracy,
yeah.
You can get his autograph before he leaves today, Scott.
So, what was the state looking for, Bill, when it wanted to acquire King's Gap?
Well, one of the things that we wanted to expand on was environmental education. And so that was the first one. And then we added, as I mentioned, Noldy Forest. Then out in Butler County, next to Marine State Park, is the Jennings Environmental Ed Center. And in Northampton County, Jacobsburg State Park. So there are now four of those throughout the state that are environmental education only.
And that's what the mansion is now. It is an environmental education center.
Yes.
Well, sort of.
It's part of it.
Well, I was going to say the state has built a separate building that actually is, I would say, the hub of, would you agree
of
with
the
that
education
yeah.
center. Okay.
But the mansion is used for that. Meetings, you can now actually spend an overnight at the mansion. You can literally rent a room. You have to go there for two nights, but they provide breakfast on a Saturday morning. So there's a lot of things going on at the mansion. Every Sunday during the summer months, fall months, we open up. People can come up free of charge, take a tour.
And there's weddings there too, right?
My daughter was married.
Really?
There, and we have the reception out on the top of the mountain, and they bring in tents. And it's just a wonderful place for any type of event.
Mm-hmm. I think about the time period, Mr. Forey, early 70s. And next year will be the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. And the nation, as well as Pennsylvania, became more environmentally aware of nature, of the environment. So it fit right in with that time period. But what kind of education do Pennsylvanians need? And at the time, and even now, that can be provided at King's Gap?
Well, one thing, the environmental education is really a necessary thing with more and more people living in urban areas. Some folks don't get the chance to be out on a hike in the woods and so forth. So it's more and more a critical thing that we get, especially young people, out to the park. So all of the 121 state parks in Pennsylvania do have some type of environmental education. A lot of them just during the summer months. But it is certainly a very big part of the program and a necessary one.
What more is needed when it comes to environmental education?
Well, one thing is hopefully that the schools, public schools and private schools throughout Pennsylvania would include that in somehow in their curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Ron, a lot of people in Cumberland County will recognize the name Maslin, not just for carpet, but Judge Maslin in Cumberland County, who currently serves. He grew up not all year round, but this was part of his early life at the mansion. And you were telling me a story about hide and seek as a as a youngster.
Yeah, he told me this, and I know he'll share it on Saturday, that they'd go up there as kids, and you know, all the cousins would get together, and then somebody would have to be the seeker. And he said, I never wanted to be the seeker. I mean, the mansion has 32 rooms. He goes, there's so many wonderful hiding places, and we'd go out and hide, and the guy would never find us. And they just had a great time, and he's going to give us some real personal insights to time at the mansion when he was a boy and a young man growing up.
Mm-hmm. Any other, we only have a few minutes left, but the history of the mansion, what else will you be talking about?
Well, again, we're going to talk about the Cameron time. I'm going to cover that. Judge Maslin will talk about the Maslin years. Mr. Forey is going to talk about the time and the involvement with the state and how it came to acquire the property. And then Scott Hackenberg, who's the current park manager, is going to give a much more in-depth insight into what exactly is the education component and where he sees that going in the future. So we're going to go from soup to nuts, beginning to end. And then at the end, we're going to provide tours of the mansion. And Mr. Forey is going to autograph anybody who buys a copy of the History of State Parks. And all those funds, by the way, don't go back to the state. They go to the Friends of King's Gap. So I was real happy about that. Sort of a contribution from this wonderful man who loves King's Gap more than anybody, I think.
Well, before you, the book came out in the early 80s, and I was reading over some of it. I was online yesterday reading over some of it. It is just so fascinating. All state parks in Pennsylvania, Maurice Goddard's goal, and I'm sure with working with you, was to have a state park within 25 miles of every Pennsylvania. But when King's Gap, you consider the history of King's Gap, this kind of goes back to what I was talking about earlier about what makes it unique. But how does it stand out amongst the other state parks?
Well, of course, every state park has its own attributes. And things
people don't know. That's one of the reasons to read your book.
Yeah, but King's Gap is so unusual because of the, first of all, a four-mile road with 36 turns in it to get to the top. And then the mansion itself makes it really unique. And I say the Nolde Forest in Berks County also is a unique one because of that mansion. But and it really seems to bring a great interest to people. In fact, the four-mile road up now has also become a biker's dream to get to the top.
Well, it has 32 turns in it, too. You know. If you're looking to get in shape, there it is. But hiking, the views, the mansion, education, there's a lot there at King's Gap. So, Ron, in a few seconds we have left, event that people who are listening can attend?
Yes. As I said, it's this Saturday morning. We start at 9 o'clock, and it's a limited event to 50 participants because we're going to do it right in the mansion. And so If people are interested, they can go to historicalsociety.com/events and sign up.
Ron Turo, member of the Cumberland County Historical Society, Friends of Kings Gap Group, and William Forey, director, retired director of the Pennsylvania State Parks and founder of Kings Gap Environmental Education Center. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Our program tomorrow is scheduled to have the president of Gettysburg College.